This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. A fight over presidential power and a longtime adversary. Today, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee considers the nuclear deal with Iran, with a bill to give Congress the right to reject that deal and to rein in the president's discretion to ease sanctions against Iran. Now, that's important because sanctions are still a key sticking point of contention between Iran and the P5 plus one. Iran wants sanctions lifted immediately if a final deal is signed. The U.S. says gradually as Iran shows that it's complying. Well, today, Secretary of State John Kerry heads to Capitol Hill with other senior administration officials to try and convince lawmakers to back off until at least June 30th, when a final deal with Iran is due. But even members of the president's own party are skeptical of the Iran nuclear deal. They want more oversight, and that includes our next guest, Senator Bob Menendez. He's a Democrat from New Jersey who, until just a few weeks ago, was the ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. And it's his bill, along with Tennessee Republican Bob Corker's, that the administration wants to avoid. Senator Menendez, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Senator, your bill gives Congress the right to reject this deal. It says the president has to certify that Iran isn't participating in any terrorist activities against the U.S. and critically says that the president can't lift sanctions for at least 60 days after the deal signed. Why is this important?
Well, I think that we've gone from a few reviews to what we will consider today before the committee. But the two core elements of the bill remain the same as we did at introduction, which is that Congress will have an opportunity to review probably the most important nuclear nonproliferation agreement of our time and to oversee Iran's compliance with the agreement and snap back sanctions if Iran deviates from its commitments. And Congress was instrumental in bringing Iran to the negotiating table because the sanctions regime was Congress's creation. And as the author of those sanctions, I can tell you that it was never intended for a wholesale ability to suspend for years. And so having a congressional role over congressionally mandated sanctions is important to make a determination. And the one thing is that this agreement does not automatically call for an up or down vote. At the end of the review period, the Congress may decide it's a good deal and doesn't want to cast a vote on it and let it move forward, or it could cast a vote of approval, or it could cast a vote of disapproval.
Right. Well, there's a full court lobbying press on from the White House today, as I mentioned, now that Congress is back. The president has said clearly he would veto your bill, but your side is getting close to the 67-vote threshold you need to overcome that veto. Is there now a deal in negotiations with Democrats to weaken this bill a bit and get those two or three votes that you and Corker will need to get a veto-proof majority here? You mentioned that some of the review language has been weakened.
It's been changed. I mean, the bottom line is that I think that we are headed towards an understanding, which I hope the White House could embrace. The White House has acknowledged many times that it was congressionally mandated sanctions that brought Iran to the table and that their diplomacy then took it the rest of the way and that Congress has a role. And this is the core central issue here. And so I believe that the changes that have been made, if they ultimately play out that way in today's markup sessions of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, will do two major things. It will take the terrorism element of it as a certification and move to reporting language that is very important. And actually, that reporting language by Ben Cardin, the new ranking member, was further extended, and I think it's good. And secondly, that the review period has been shortened depending upon when the administration submits any final deal, if there is a final deal, to the Congress. And it would seem to me that those two elements are really significant efforts to assuage the administration. This is about really having a congressional role to review the deal, not simply to oppose any deal.
And you have a sense from the Democrats that you've been helping to negotiate with that those changes you mentioned might get this beyond the president's grasp here?
Well, I certainly believe that if these changes are embodied in the language we see today, then that we will have a very strong bipartisan vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And I think that would be a prelude to a very strong bipartisan vote on the Senate floor.
Senator, listeners will have seen and heard that you're facing a multi-count indictment on corruption charges. You haven't gone to trial. You've denied all those charges strongly. You've said that the charges are not political retribution for opposing the White House on this issue, on Cuba, on other key issues. But what about the timing? Was the timing of those charges, do you think, set to sideline you? Many people noticed that the charges came out the day before this controversial Iran deal was announced.
Look, I can't comment on the timing. That was totally in the government's realm to pursue. There is no question that I have had strong views about how we promote democracy and human rights in Cuba and how we stop Iran from achieving nuclear weapons capability. And I have had a very strong view about those issues. I've expressed them openly. And, you know, when I have a principled disagreement, I'm not hesitant to pursue my views. And when I have strong agreement with this president or any other president, I strongly support him. So that's the way I've conducted myself in 23 years, and nothing will change for me in that regard. That's why I'm still pressing ahead. I'm glad to see the negotiations have taken place to a point that I hope the administration can embrace the legislation. I think it would make sense. And I think when members review the legislation, they will come to an understanding that this is an appropriate role for Congress to play on one of the most critical foreign policy issues of our time.
Senator Robert Menendez is the former head of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. He's also the co-author of a key bill heading to the Senate today and as early as next week that would in some ways weaken the administration's hand on enforcing a nuclear deal with Iran. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
My Bartoli, I don't know how to write love letters, but I wanted to tell you that my whole being opened for you. Since I fell in love with you, everything is transformed and is full of beauty. Love is like an aroma, like a current, like rain. You know my sky, you rain on me, and I, like the earth, receive you.
This Wednesday, a New York auction house will put 25 love letters written by Mexican artist Frida Kahlo up for sale. That one you just heard there was from October in 1946. Now, those letters are addressed to Kahlo's lover, Jose Bartoli. He was a Spanish artist that she met while in New York having painful spinal surgery. Kahlo, of course, was married to artist Diego Rivera at the time. The letters are notable for their steaminess, but also for how completely vulnerable they reveal Kahlo to be. And they do say a lot about her work. So with me to explain is art historian Hayden Herrera. She's author of Frida, a biography of Frida Kahlo. Her latest book, a biography of sculptor Isamu Noguchi, will be published later this month. Hayden, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So there is a lot of steaminess in these letters, without a doubt. We might get to that, but a lot of them, what's fascinating about them is how closely they correlate to a lot of her work. You can read renditions of her prose in these letters that are reflected in some of her paintings.
Yeah, yes, that is true, especially the painting that she did soon after the spinal fusion in New York. It's called Tree of Hope. It's a painting in which Frida appears twice. Once she's recumbent on a hospital trolley with great wounds in her back, the incisions from the surgery, and next to her is a strong Frida holding a flag that says, Tree of Hope, Keep Firm, which was her motto and also the first line of a song, a Mexican song, that both she and Bartoli loved.
Tree of Hope, however, was him. She referred to him as her Tree of Hope.
Yes, she did. In many of the letters, she says he is her Tree of Hope. And in a way, she keeps telling him that without him, she can't be strong, she can't paint, she won't be happy, she'll be lonely.
These letters have hand-drawn sketches by her. He responded with some as well. Some of them, as I said, do provide sort of conceptual frameworks for things that appeared in paintings later on that enthusiasts might really be interested in. Who was Jose Bartoli, however?
Bartoli was a Spanish refugee. He fought in the Spanish Civil War, and then he was imprisoned in several concentration camps In one of them, he secretly drew all the horrible things that he saw, escaped, and went to Africa, and then finally landed in Mexico, where he lived apparently until 1946. And then after that, he mainly lived in New York City.
They met in New York, as I said, when she was here having surgery. And then for the next 3 or 4 years, what appears to have been a very tumultuous affair, but full of a lot of longing. They don't seem to have seen each other very much, even though there was a lot of infatuation.
Right. When Frida Kahlo was recovering from the spinal surgery, she returned to Mexico, and he seems to have appeared in Mexico about 2 weeks later. So they were together for a while. Then he had to go back to New York. And then there's a period in 1947 where apparently he came to Mexico and didn't even see her. Then their love affair seems to have resumed in 1949, according to the letters. I was wondering whether his not visiting her when he came to Mexico in 1947 had something to do with what you see in these letters, which is her extreme neediness. She is constantly telling him that without him, she can't live, she can't paint, etc. So he may have felt a little bit under pressure. They're a little bit claustrophobic sometimes.
Today we call that a little bit freaked out, maybe.
A little freaked out, yes.
Well, I want to ask you about that very thing, because what was fascinating to me, of course, as I've said, is how some of the letters narrate, in a way, the concepts in paintings that you can see in books, in a museum, maybe in someone's collection. But what do they say about her inner world? You started to allude to it, not what she puts on the canvas necessarily, but what was going on in her life.
Well, she had a horrible accident when she was a teenager, and she almost died. And her life after that was full of pain and many, many operations, some 35 or something like that. Many of her paintings are about physical pain. A great number of them are about emotional pain. She was married to Diego Rivera, who was a well-known philanderer. So there are paintings in which her heart is broken by Rivera. There are others in which, for example, The Broken Column from 1944, where she shows herself naked from the waist up, split open with a broken, crumbling ionic column replacing her own spinal column, and also with nails piercing her flesh. She's sort of like a female Saint Sebastian.
It's extraordinarily intimate stuff, and I mean the letters. We should point out that it was Jose Bartoli's family that discovered the letters in a chest after his death. They're now putting these up for sale, right? Do you see it as a violation of her privacy or even his?
You know, I don't, because the one thing that Frida Kahlo wanted in life, I think, is to be known. Look at her painting. She painted herself being born with spread legs, with a baby coming out from between her legs. She painted herself having a miscarriage in Detroit. She didn't hold back. She was very, and also in life, she was extremely forthcoming, very direct. So I don't think she would have been upset to have these letters published.
Up to $125,000 is the estimate for more than two dozen love letters between Spanish artist Jose Bartoli and Mexican legendary artist Frida Kahlo. Hayden Herrera, author of Frida, A Biography of Frida Kahlo, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, your love letters might not ever be put up for auction, but they still mean a lot to you, of course. And we want to know, what's the most meaningful love letter you've ever received? From Alexandria in Minnesota, I received a letter from my father while I was deployed in Iraq, and in that letter there was a paragraph that I will carry with me for the rest of my life. It said, "I imagine that there will be days when you would rather be under a truck than inside of it, but hopefully those days will be outweighed by the opposite. Keep your head down and your spirits up, and know that this experience will be a catalyst for the man that you become." At the end, it was signed, "Love you, Dad."
My name is Eric. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. And the most meaningful love letter I've ever received was from my first love, 8 years after we broke up. Her letter is an appreciation of the love we had when we were younger, and a celebration of how our love has evolved as friends despite our physical distance.
Hi, my name is Tom from Colts Neck, New Jersey. The most meaningful love letter I ever received was a poem that was actually written in the letters of my name, which is a phrase from an early Grateful Dead song written by Bob Weir and John Barlow called "Looks Like Rain." So every line of the poem began with a letter of my name written vertically down the page. And it was beautiful, and I'll remember it for the rest of my life.
Share your letters with us, the ones that you can, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry, and I do try to reply to as many tweets as I can. Thanks for choosing us to listen to. Our motto is share what you know, and there are plenty of ways of doing that. Check us out. Take part in the show. There's more at thetakeaway.org.
The artist class is yielding to the nouveau riche hipster. That's musician Amy Spies talking about her adopted hometown of East Nashville in Tennessee. It's not an unfamiliar story to music fans and folks who live in the great American music cities when artists' communities give way to fast, new, high-money development. Amy wrote that line in a New York Times op-ed last month entitled, "A Singer-Songwriter Just Trying to Make Do." Amy Spies is dealing with being a working-class musician, an occupation already made hard by streaming internet, YouTube, and the onset of the digital age that makes it hard for artists to make real money. And now, quick urban development in her hometown has made it hard to buy property, hard to get by, harder than it has ever been for the artist. Amy Spies joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
What's your story of the working musician now in the changing economy?
Well, it's, you know, the major labels started breaking down a bunch of years ago. So it made a lot of us who were not going to be on the sort of major label path. We're the journey people of the working class. And so we have to make our way by finding independent labels. We find independent booking agents where we book our own tours and shows. We have to find our niche audiences. And the internet has really given rise to our ability to do that, whether I'm a folk artist. There's Americana artists, there's bluegrass artists, indie rock artists who are finding their own little niche audiences through internet radio. So it's been an amazing boom for a lot of music to come through that might not have had the financial support in the old days of the major label system.
You make most of your money on the road in the bars and clubs that you play. What's it like?
To be perfectly frank, we're not making money on record sales. Almost nobody is. Nobody, I mean, Taylor Swift might be the only one who's doing it. Even major artists aren't making the sales that they were making, you know, 5-10 years ago. So those of us sort of in the, you know, in the middle class ranks, a record that we make is really almost like a business card. You know, we are selling them, but the, you know, the margins are smaller and smaller. So we're making our living from live shows.
So ticket sales and the merch table, more important than ever. It used to be the reverse. It used to be that the tour supported the album, and now it's the other way around.
Yeah, and there's not much, you know, it used to be that labels gave tour support. So they would give money for artists to pay for gas, to pay for musicians, to buy the rental van. That's not happening anymore, even in, and I'm on an independent label. And so I do have some support in terms of being able to make my record. But once I'm out there, it's all on me.
And trash trucks are starting to run. The air's warm, but I'm freezing. And I never needed no one. Just come pick me up.
Music, especially for the person starting out, has always been for the hungry person, the driven artist, somebody who wants to express their art and might be willing to go to any length to do it. Now that it's even more difficult economically, is it more of a self-selected group now? I mean, is the barrier to entry, if you had a kid coming up, an 18-year-old musician, would you say, gosh, you know, it was hard to make a living before, now I don't know?
No, I think what's interesting is more people are getting into it because there's so many ways of getting heard thanks to the internet. So there's, it used to be there was a gatekeeper, and that was the major label. You couldn't make a record. You couldn't find a producer. You couldn't get into a studio. Now there's a studio behind everybody's house in Nashville, Tennessee. So anybody can make a record. Anybody can throw a record up on the internet. Anybody can get their single to iTunes. What happens is it starts to fall off about year 2, 3, 4 when people realize it's going to be a long slog for the most part in order to make a living from it. So I've been doing this for 15 years, and it's always been a hard slog, but I make a living. I don't make a huge living. I make enough to pay my expenses and a little bit more. But a lot of people that I started out with left 10 years ago to have families, to buy a big house, to get a 401k plan, things that I don't have.
All right. Well, let's help each other out here a little bit. Enough talk about the economy of music. Let's hear some actual music. You're going to play a song for us.
Yeah, I'm going to play a song that's not anything about money, nothing about the economy. It's actually about love and heartbreak, which is kind of what I specialize in. It's from my new record. The song is called Better Than This.
Great. Here's Amy Spies.
I swore I wouldn't call, but you said you might stop by. So now I'm staring not to care, trying to fill the time. I cleared you out some space, but you never quite unpacked. There's no way to know if you're running
Spies' latest album is called That Kind of Girl. It's available on iTunes and Amazon, and especially at your local independent record store. You can also find it at Amy Spies' website. That's amyspies.com, like peace, with an S on the front of it. And you can hear this entire song at our website at thetakeaway.org.
It's like you hedged your bet. You gotta play your hand. Sit it out. I can do better than a half kiss. I can do better than a near miss. I can do better. I can do better than this. I don't want.
We have a lot of great music on The Takeaway, and we've been thrilled to have lots of artists play in our studios, just like Amy Spies. We've had Mike Doty, Red Barat, the Budos Band, and many more. We've made a playlist of all of those live performances for our CR4 Live series. That's Control Room 4. That's where the magic happens, folks. You can check it out at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
My next guest, Mike Finkel, was a celebrated New York Times reporter who, after embellishing a high-profile cover story, found himself fired and disgraced and desperately seeking work. A lucky but totally bizarre break then came along when a man stole Finkel's identity, and that man wasn't a petty thief, but an accused murderer.
Hello?
Hi, I'm a reporter with the Oregonian. I wanted to get your side on the Christian Longo story.
Who?
He murdered his entire family.
Why are you telling me this?
Because when they apprehended him, he said he was Mike Finkel of the New York Times.
That's a clip from the new film True Story, starring Jonah Hill and James Franco. And it tells the story of how the real Mike Finkel decided to meet the accused murderer who stole his identity and the unlikely relationship and writing project that the two of them formed. The film opens on April 17th. The real Mike Finkel is sitting with me now in the studio. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
I described this relationship that you formed with this accused murderer who assumed your identity as a lucky break. Is that fair? Is that what this became for you after your career was sort of ruined at the Times?
I'm hesitant to use the word blessing, but it was the fact that this guy used my name was helpful to me on some level. It gave me a connection. He brought me into this story, and not just any guy, a guy who's on the 10 most wanted list for the FBI next to Osama bin Laden at the time. And how could you not? I mean, I'm a journalist through and through. How could you not be curious about that, especially the almost cosmic, almost divine intervention sort of nature of that coincidence?
So the moment is depicted in the clip that we played. That's Jonah Hill who's playing you. You pick up the phone, learn that an accused murderer is impersonating you. And how long does it take you to decide, I got to meet this guy?
Right. So I pick up the phone thinking that a journalist is about to, you know, tear into me for being fired for the New York Times. I'm talking about the exact same day. And yet I pick up the phone and a guy from the Oregonian, it happened in real life, almost exactly like that, says to me, you know, what do you have to say about the murders? It probably took me a nanosecond to realize that there was, you know, my journalistic senses were tingling, and I was like, I need to know more about this. Why would someone take on my identity? What happened? Who, you know, the trail of questions was almost endless right away.
Tell me how the relationship started. You met up, I assume, in a visiting room at the county lockup, maybe across the glass or some grating.
Exactly. So I sit across from this guy. The single scariest thing about Christian Longo is that there is nothing scary about him at all. I pride myself on being a good journalist, being able to read people. Oh, this is, you know, you're in the Middle East. No, maybe you shouldn't go here. Maybe you shouldn't do this. Or here's a bad person. It pulled the rug out from under me and my understanding of people. Here's a guy who, look, has a baby face, has a warm personality, has an engaging wit. You think to yourself, there is just no way that I'm looking at someone who could have murdered three children and his wife.
And yet,
the facts of the case. Four bodies found in the Oregon coast, one live guy found under a pseudonym in Mexico. Doesn't look good. Looks me in the eye, tells me he's innocent. Not only that, he says, I know you just got fired. I know that you can't afford to make even the tiniest of missteps. All I ask is for you to be a complete and thorough journalist. Listen to me, and I will prove to you that I'm innocent.
So the subject matter of your book in telling his story, he is trying to establish his innocence. He wants to use you as a vessel to establish his own innocence?
Yeah, there's a little cat and mouse game quality. He's awaiting trial. There's 9 months he's in jail. He's talking to me. Everything he tells me, I'm running around, of course, trying to double check, triple check. I can't afford to make even a slight misstep. And he knows this. And it turns out that he very well was sort of rehearsing his, you know, the speech that he was rehearsing his defense. He knew that I would go and check everything, and any little wobble, any misinformation, I would bring up to him and he would correct it. And I was inadvertently trying to help him get away with murder.
And are you okay with having even unwittingly been an accessory to a murderer's attempted defense or attempted exoneration?
No, I'm not okay. I'm not okay with really any part of this story. There's no... It's a really uncomfortable story to me. We can never forget that there are real victims here. Mary Jane, Christian Longo's wife, her family is obviously, I can't even imagine how they might feel, devastated. And even Christian Longo's parents, who lost all their grandchildren on the hand of their own child. You know, there's true victims here. So I'm deeply emotionally involved in it, but that doesn't mean I'm comfortable.
At the same time, is he a friend now after all that you've been through with him?
Friend is much too simple a word to use in a story this complicated, but I do have a relationship with him.
What's the word?
I think you need a book length.
Well, try a few. What is he to you at this point?
You know, he is a doppelganger on some level. Sometimes I think about something like this. You know, you smoke one cigarette and you look at the package, the picture on the package. It's like, you know, this black lung. He's like this warning sign to me, the size of a billboard. It's like, before he was a murderer, what he really was a liar. And he's sort of like this terrible warning sign. It's like the worst you could ever imagine of a person writ large, and yet took on my identity for some reasons. He's like this, I don't know, he's like this warning sign to me on some level.
Warning of what? What could happen?
If
you look at him and before he was a murderer, he was a liar. People said that you were a liar. I'm not suggesting that you're anywhere on the path to murder, but you chose the word that before he was this monster, he was just a liar, just like you.
Right. Obviously, there's no equivalency between writing a flawed story and murdering your family. But like I said, and maybe I'm just putting this on it in my own mind, but the profound coincidence of him taking on my identity, the moment I lost my own, it has some weird cosmic and profound meaning to me. You lie about, you know, one story, and who knows what chasm can open in the earth. And there's some tiny poke of Christian Longo that lives in my head that is a profound warning of how horrible things can go.
Would you go back to the New York Times now if you could?
New York Times is a fantastic newspaper, and New York Times Magazine is great. I don't think that's an option.
Right. The film is True Story. It opens April 17th. It is the true story of Mike Finkel and his doppelganger, the person who assumed his identity, Christian Longo. They're both played by James Franco and Jonah Hill. Mike Finkel, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And before we go, a quick note about the date to take with you today. Ceremonies are being held around the world today to mark 1 year since more than 200 girls were abducted by Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. The campaign to bring back our girls continues, and today, the Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai has published an open letter to the schoolgirls. She said the world has not forgotten.
Remember that one day your tragic ordeal will end, and you will have the chance to finish the education you courageously sought. I look forward to the day I can hug each one of you, pray with you, and celebrate your freedom with your families.
Words of support from a Nobel Peace Prize winner, Malala Yousafzai, who knows what it's like to be assaulted by terrorists. Though it is worth also noting that so far, hashtags and public awareness have not brought those girls back. You can read Malala Yousafzai's letter on our website at thetakeaway.org. And if you want to take The Takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news, available on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast fix. You can follow me on Twitter. Ask me anything about politics or Washington or anything at all. I'm at Todd Zwillick on the Twitter machine. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is back tomorrow. It's been a pleasure. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.